This video is green. It's dark green. And I just could not see that yesterday.
Welcome to Clocker Counter. I'm Ryan Young, and with me is James Wiseman. So today we're going to talk about Frisbeer. Before that, we need to do some catch up because we haven't talked in a long time and I need an update from Duke.
So the update's pretty boring because I've been out now for 2 or 3 months with this injury. I know that the Duke main players, Will, Ray, Matthew, are playing all the time. They're sending me videos doing amazing stuff. I think Ray could be a breakout player at Worlds this year. He's starting to hit that threshold where he goes from a player who's really good at some things but missing some fundamentals to a player who has enough fundamentals that he's sort of skyrocketing in skill level. But one thing I'm personally excited about is a big spin factor remodel. We're going to have instant playback soon. We're going to have updated acoustics. We're going to have freestyle art from all these amazing freestylers around the world, which I'm super grateful for the people that sent me stuff. I'm probably going to like miss somebody, but I know I got amazing art from Dunk in Berlin, Jakub Machoła, aka Mystique in Prague, Konrad Patrice in Poland, Raphael Legrand in France. I think Julien is going to send me some stuff from France, although I know he's moving to Berlin right now. So huge shout out to the community for no questions asked, sending me this amazing art that I can't wait to put up. But otherwise, I've just been rehabbing. I'm super eager to get back to freestyling. I'm hoping to make at least some kind of appearance in Virginia. And I guess the good side of all this is whatever, I got the motivation build up, you know, I'm back to feeling like I really want to freestyle. I watched all of Frisbeer on the live stream, which thanks to everyone who put it together. I know Jakub, Dexter, all the Jakubs, Jakub Machoła, Jakub Kosztel, Dexter, so many other people involved in that. It was amazing to watch it. And I think normally when I watch tournaments, I'm a little bit bored, I think, because I'm freestyling every day and I don't find it all super impressive. I mean, it depends on the round. But I mean, if you just watch every round of a tournament, there's going to be some dull rounds at every single round. I was like, this is amazing. People are throwing a frisbee and they're pulling it. It was almost like when you first see freestyle, and I'm like, they're spinning it on their finger. Can you believe this? So I was super fired up watching it.
Are you going to Frisbeer next year?
Margaret and I talked about it. There's actually a quick little digression. We had to get a baby passport and we had to get it as soon as we could because we're hoping to go to Toronto. Although honestly, it's going to work out for me, I think, but I'm not sure. My wife and child are going to be going to Toronto. We'll see. But our consolation prize, no matter what, but especially because we're worried we'll make Toronto, is we're going to try to take the whole family to Prague next year. So really excited about that. I've never brought my wife to Prague, even though the Czech Republic has a big place in my heart. And it'd be really cool to bring my daughter there, you know, in her actual first year of life. So look out for that. I'm sure you'll talk about it more, but I love the idea of this 24-hour gym where we could get way more jamming in. And so, yeah, I think I'll be there next year, but no promises.
Cool. Anything else from your side?
I'm pretty boring these days. Sorry about that.
So I got a new camera from after I retired, and I've been making videos. And I'm curious, we've talked a little bit, but like, what do you think of my new videos that I made? So there's like two categories. There's like the short player profile videos, and then there's like the mic'd up videos.
When you say player profile videos, you mean like the mic video? Yep, and the exactly. Tag video. So I think I've watched all the videos, and I recently learned that a video I watched you had made and I didn't even realize it. And my honest assessment is absolute jealousy. And for background, I remember when I first got into shooting video with cameras, you had already been doing it for a little while, and I always thought the videos you made were so beautiful. You were shooting with a Canon Mark III back in the day, which is the sickest camera back in 2009 or 2010. It has to be sort of the first. That was a DSLR camera, though, right?
Yeah.
It was like the first consumer DSLR hybrid that really shot magnificent video, although it was limited to 720p, I think.
At 60 FPS, yeah.
But one of its big selling points is it looked amazing out of the box. Like, you just could put the footage on your computer and it looked amazing. But nevertheless, you were so good at coloring it and just making it look nice. And I got the wrong camera and wasn't as skilled. And I feel like my videos never looked that good. But obviously I've spent 12 or 13 years making videos now. And I feel like I've gotten better in a lot of ways, but I'm still always a little bit like, I wish I were better at coloring. I made hundreds of videos, so I don't really have time to make them beautiful. But you come back and the first video off the bat, I'm like, it's so beautiful. Like, how can you spend so little time thinking about this stuff and already be so much better than me at this? Again, I'm not good at it, but like, where do you even do it? I think I hate talking about talent. You know, we always talk about the growth mindset, but I do think you have an eye for this, just a natural high starting point, and it's so impressive.
I think it's, we look value different things, because when we talk about other people's videos, you always comment on something that I don't care about, and then you comment and I say something, you're like, oh yeah, that's something else. So it's just a factor of like, I care about the lighting and the color way more than you. You care about like resolution and like sharpness, I think, more. Like, I don't care about those things.
I do care about color. The problem is I just can't do it. The story in my life, and I know there are ways around this, but I'm telling you, I think my eyes just don't work right. I will edit a video and I'll think I nailed the colors, and I'll encode it or whatever, and I'll come back the next day and I'll open up the video. I'm like, this video is green. It's dark green. And I just could not see that yesterday. I can hold up a white piece of paper. I can download a white chart and look at it. Like, at some point, my brain just gets all cattywampus and I can't see the colors well anymore. But you're definitely right about what you said. I think is right, but in a different way. I think I appreciate those things after the fact the same way that you do, but I don't appreciate or put in the work that is required to make videos look the way I want to once I'm getting to the post-processing phase. Because unlike me, you spend a lot more time thinking about getting the lighting right while you're filming.
Yeah, like that's before we go out there. I'm just like, how's the lighting going to work and which way I'm going to face?
But in fairness, I'm just trying to do something different now. You know, when we first started making videos, we were doing it mostly together. Mm-hmm. And we were waking up at 6 a.m. and filming yeah. during the golden hour, and it looked a lot better. But I'm a volume business now. I'm a McDonald's, you know? you don't come to me for a Peter Luger steak, you know? You come for me for cheap fast food. Like, I just am giving you hours. And they're not all high quality, but they're out there. It's a different kind of service. And I would love to be in your business because I'd be more proud of what I do. But it's just not been in the cards for me lately.
Okay. What's your opinion on the mic'd up jamming?
I really like it. I think, like anything, there's room for improvement from generation one. I think the part of it that really works for me is the story arc. So just for anyone listening who doesn't know what this is something you had talked about a lot, and then you just sort of did it, which is awesome. But just having players with microphones on them while they're jamming so that you can get kind of the back and forth talking that they're doing. And I'm sure this is partially by design, but it's also just kind of part of your mentoring. What you did in the mic'd up videos you've made so far is you sort of set the stakes early of like, I'm working on this, you're working on that. And a lot of the clips that you ultimately put into the video are the moments where those objectives are playing out. And that gives a storyline to the video of, you know, the goal, you see them work through the goal, and then you see examples of them accomplishing the goal. So there was one video, for example, where I know your goal was to spin before every catch. So you hear you describing that's your goal. We see you failing a few times and we see you succeeding a few times. So it gives a nice arc to it. I think the part that I didn't love so much about the mic'd up is that when you're capturing the mic'd up, you now have two different things that ideally would sync up to make the video compelling. You would have both the good conversation and the good freestyle. But unfortunately, those are often not going to sync up. So sometimes the interesting conversation is when the disc is sitting on the ground or not really doing anything fun. But you have to like cut out some of the great freestyle because it doesn't contribute to the story arc. So I think dialing that balance in, which is partially players getting used to watching these and making them or participating mm-hmm. in them. And I don't know, like using, like, I hate to say this, but I also think like if you had super high skilled players, it would be much easier to sync those two things. And it would be very exciting to see, like, okay, you're working on this crazy thing. And even your mistakes are going to be compelling from a freestyle perspective. Plus we get the mic aspect of it.
I agree. Cause I saw this format from another video. It was cheerleaders, so like stunting where they throw the people in the air, which has nothing to do with frisbee. And when I watched that video, I was like, this is amazing. Like, I have no knowledge of cheerleading at all, but when I watch the videos, it's awesome because the dialogue draws me in. But you're right, all the people in the videos are elite, like, level cheerleaders that are doing really hard things, but it like looks easy. So I think the floor is really high skill wise, and that is probably very important to the success of that, like those videos. So the problem for me is like, I have to talk. Like, I wish I didn't have to be mic'd up. I wish there were two other people that are mic'd up and I could just like contribute to the jam in another way.
So I'm glad you started it, because I was going to go there even if you hadn't. And I was trying to think of the most diplomatic way to say it. Not for you, because me and you talk very openly to each other, but I didn't want to seem too harsh on the podcast. But yeah, I agree that I know that talking, and it's obviously, we talk about it before, we're making a podcast, we get it. And these days that you retired, it's really like you're the producer, host. I'm just the babbler now.
You're the talent.
But I totally sympathize with, now you have to take on this role that's not the role that you would necessarily want to take on for yourself, and puts a lot more pressure on you. I mean, even me, I think I'm obviously a talker, but I think the perfect person to be mic'd up is Dougie Fresh. You need a bunch of Dougie Freshes out there who their baseline banter is so interesting, funny, and entertaining that I could carry it by itself. But that's not really your personality or your style, so it makes it a little bit more challenging to do. But I felt that same burden in other ways. Like, I always thought, like, for instance, when we first did the Spread the Jam project, and I would still feel this way now, but it was certainly more acute then, I knew that Dan and I weren't that good at freestyle yet, but we were the only young Americans who could be filmed in New York City with the person that we had to do the filming. And I remember feeling that burden of like, I wish there was somebody like me, but who was 10 times better at freestyle, who could do this, but yeah. No one else is going to do it, so it has to be me, and I'm the best we got right now for this particular project. And I think you're in that situation in a lot of ways of like, this isn't what you would want to do from a personality perspective. You'd rather be the person who sets up the person that does it, but because that person doesn't exist and is not going to do it, you're the one who has to do it. I mean, to some degree, I feel that about this podcast. Like, this podcast I'm better suited for in some ways, because I do like talking. I'm sort of embarrassed about that, about myself. My mom was just here to see her grandchild, and I'm like, yeah, man, this is what I'm like. It must be terrible for people. But at the same time, even this, there are aspects of it that I really don't like and aren't well suited for me. Like, I'm so nervous about saying the wrong thing all the time, even though I obviously say the wrong thing all the time, that I would much rather be designing the ideas for the podcast and doing like the research work and giving it to someone way more compelling than me. Like, if I could just combine my brain with Dougie's brain into a person and put it on this podcast, I would love that person to do the podcast, not me. But that person doesn't exist, and Dougie's not going to start making a podcast every week.
Yep. So we're doing the best with what we can. But this is just, this is proof of concept. I think it is good enough to keep going when you say it crossed that bar. Yeah.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I think it's probably fun for people to make. I also think it will be fun to get to know people more. Like, so far it's been people I mostly know not well. But like, I talk with Micah just for fun. So like, I sort of know what she's like. I don't know Timic that well, but like, I didn't learn that much new about him from watching one of the ones where he was in. But there was lots of others I don't know very well that it'd be kind of fun to learn about their personalities. And I think a lot of people would shine in ways that we haven't seen before. So I think there's a lot of good proof of concept in it, and I'm super excited to see what you do with it.
Cool. Also, we didn't talk about this in our little catch up beforehand, but I think my brain is at a point where I can start doing hard stuff again. At some point, it would be nice for me to be good enough, or to get like to like half of the Dougie level in my talking capacity. Like, maybe that could be one of my
growth mindset. I mean, we always talk about you can get better at anything. Like, I think I'll say two things. Like, one, a lot of my personality, which can lend towards comedic, like, I try to have a sense of humor and I like joke around a lot. I think a lot of that comes from my best friend growing up. He was like that. And so I think a lot of that I got from him. And I still have a way of speaking and a rhythm of speaking that I think comes from him a lot. So I think in more ways than I think we give credence to, our personalities can be learned attributes from the people around us, especially the people that we love and admire. I also think a lot of my jamming persona in terms of like how I speak and what I say is from Dougie / the larger New York freestyle community. Sometimes to my detriment, because I think, oh, like these people think I'm being mean because they don't know that this is part of sort of like a friendly heckling banter from New York. And I have to kind of check myself. So in that sense, I think it's something that you could practice and learn and get better at like anything else, even though it might be the kind of thing we might not normally think is that easy to change.
All right.
But the hard part, I think, is it's a little bit of fake it till you make it, you know, like you're just going to have
that's
like,
what awkwardly... I'm doing. I'm faking it right now. But it's...
yeah, you just have trying. To awkwardly talk in ways that are totally unnatural to you until they become more natural.
Okay. Someday.
Someday.
All right. Frisbeer.
Frisbeer. Tell me about it.
Okay. So there were a couple new things. I think I have three of them in my list. So the first one was we're just going to go in whatever order. The first one was everyone had to use an X-Disc Air to compete with.
Mm.
And from a layman's person, like anyone who's never can't delay would probably not know the difference between a SkyStyler and the X-Disc. But there is a huge difference between the X-Disc and the SkyStyler. So like, just as like a first example, I play with Timic this year and I went to practice and we did a 2-disc routine, but we only had one X-Disc to practice with and we had one SkyStyler. So we always started the SkyStyler and the X-Disc in the same positions when we were practicing, except for one run through where they were just like backwards for some weird reason. And we could not do the routine with the discs in the reverse order. Like that's how big the difference is between the two at like a competitive level. And so what I learned was the biggest thing is the X disc is smaller and lighter and carries less spin, like at all times. That sounds really bad when you just say it out loud, but after one day of only playing, so the first day of Frisbeer was just all jamming this year. And after that first day, everyone was using an X-Disc. I adjusted and like the SkyStyler felt like the 4-in-1 to me after that. Like I was like, why is this so big and heavy? And when it hits my hand, when I catch, it like does the thing where it like twists out of my hand. And like the X-Disc just like felt like the normal disc after one day of jamming. So I think it, like I never, that was like the first exposure I had to like immersion. The immersion of the X-Disc.
Let me pause you there because that was not our experience. Where when the X-Disc first came out, we jammed with it at Duke for several weeks. And I think not only did we not feel like we adjusted, like my plan originally was to play with it exclusively for 6 months. And I just got so fed up with it that I couldn't. Now, I want to be clear that I totally support the X-Disc. I think it's totally fine if they sponsor tournaments and make people play with them. And I'm hopeful that they will improve in the future. And if you know, the SkyStyler disappeared, I would play with the X-Disc and not complain too much about it. But I find it better at a few things, but still overall inferior in a way that I find hard to overlook. Although I'm interested in different ways to prep the disc, which I've heard there might be some developments in. I tried a few different ways, none of which seemed to make a big difference.
We'll talk about that too, yeah.
And since Frisbeer, I really can't play right now because of my injury, but I got a Z machine to kind of like at least like delay it and like try a couple things that don't really involve my body moving. I'm acutely aware of how much less spin it holds from the few things that I can do. But one of the things I've been working on with the Z machine, it's a little bit awkward to get into it, is I've been working a lot on my guides, and it's half the guide potential on a X-Disc. I never like counted it out. It sounds like very little, but it's actually a lot. But if I guide a SkyStyler, it will guide for, let's say, 5 or 6 seconds before it runs out of spin. Not like I lose it. Like I can do it until there is no spin left. So like that's the max you get on the SkyStyler, or at least how I got it. Maybe there's a better technique. When I do the X-Disc, it's probably half that. Like maybe even a little bit less. Like that's super noticeable. And that turns the guide from something that is visually very compelling. Because I think a guide needs to happen for a certain amount of time for especially a lay person's brain to sort of process what's happening and realize what's cool about it. But with the X-Disc, it guides for such a short period of time that, and it kind of is a little bit bouncy. I don't know what causes it, that it just doesn't really, the guiding's not really a good process on the X desk, and that's super disappointing.
I see.
But I'm also fired up about the ridge. Like, I get a whole new set of moves with the ridge. So, like, there's a trade-off there. But because I've been focused on those two things, that's all I can really do right now. I've just been bummed that the X disc doesn't really work for me.
I see. There's this other phenomenon that's weird. So leading up to, like, I went to Warsaw early to, like, jam and practice. And that whole time we were using the X disc. And that for that whole week, I did not adjust. So even in the mic'd up jam, you can hear me complain about the X disc the whole time. But it wasn't until, like, one day at Frisbeer. Maybe Frisbeer just got a second run of plastic. And maybe that's what changed. I don't know. But it was now after Frisbeer, it's like, I've adapted. Like, it, I know what you mean. Like, we jammed for a whole week and I was like, this is inferior in every way, but now it doesn't feel like that. So I wonder if there is a way or
that,
something.
I mean, that would be great. I mean, we've talked before when we talked about the X-Disc that Skystylers vary tremendously between runs. So there's no reason to think the X-Disc wouldn't be different. And in addition, I think they are purposely iterating on the X-Disc to try to make it better. So if there's a new run out there that would change my life, I would be thrilled. And I'll probably text Daniel after this to see what I can learn about that and maybe order some more of them. But I was actually having this sort of like dark thought. I don't know if it's a dark thought, but I was thinking like, I'm going to be sad. It's taking my baseline assumptions about the X-Disc, which might not be right. And things can change. Like when I was first watching Frisbeer, I didn't know that everyone was required to use an X-Disc. And I was kind of like, wow, it's too bad that like this jammer like thinks the X-Disc is better because they're wrong. And like, it's just going to be worse for them. And I just started thinking like most people probably aren't good enough, at least now, to know how much worse it is. And they're going to use it for whatever reason and it's going to hold them back. So like that worries me for some people. But if it is better in some way, then I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we should talk about the new X-Disc prep. So there are three methods that I've tried. So one is my normal Skystyler setup. One is no prep at all. And one is the Toby prep that he brought like a station. He set up a station at Frisbeer. So my normal prep is just sanding it with 1,000 by hand and then slicking it and letting it marinate. And then after a break-in period, it gets really fast. So like with the Skystyler, I do this. And for like the first 2 hours of jamming with it, it feels really slow. And then once the disc gets eaten up, it gets really fast. But the X disc never got fast. It just stayed slow the entire time, its entire life. Yeah. And that was disappointing. But at disc or at Frisbeer, we got another X disc in the player pack. And that one I just slicked, no prep at all. There's like no nipple on the X disc either, which is really nice. And that disc was fast. And I was like, wow, maybe this is just better for everyone because people without tools can just have a fast disc right out of the box. And then I used one of Toby's prep discs. So what he does is he has a power drill that he's plugged into the wall and he has a buffing pad that like is used for like car repairs, like repairing paint. And he starts with 2,000 and then he goes with 10,000. After that, and he's like putting his weight into the disc as he's doing this at like full blast. And I think what is happening is when you polish a car, you're not actually sanding, you're melting the paint, and when it cools down like in a smooth fashion. And I think that's what's happening in the Toby method, and it feels really good. Like, I didn't jam a lot with the Toby disc, but it felt like glass. I don't know. It felt like that slippery ice feeling, not like plastic.
I mean, that sounds fantastic. I will say, before I knew any of this, I had tried a variation of the Toby technique because I have a buffing sander and I sanded 3 X discs with various grits, but I had never thought to go up to 10,000 grit. Cause like normally with a Skystyler, you can't really tell the difference between 1,000 and above. Mm-hmm. So I actually tried 3. Like, I did one at 800. That was the last one where I was like, and I'll try anything now. That was a disaster. But like, I think the highest I had was 1200 or maybe 2000. And that didn't really make a difference with mine. It was weird because they felt a little bit more glassy. And I get how unscientific this is. It's so unscientific. I wouldn't put any credence into it really. But like, then I just was taking all my variations of them and seeing how long I could delay them and just sort of like writing down how long. And like, they were all the same, even if they felt pretty different. But I can replicate Toby's technique now, though. Maybe I'll have to ask him for more details. I mean, I did ask him, but he hasn't gotten me back yet. Toby, if you're listening, get back with me. But I'll get some 10,000 grit sandpaper or buffing paper, put it on my tool and see if I can get a difference. But it might just be that the new run is way better. But that would solve one big problem, which is the speed. But the other thing I have trouble with, although it's an advantage for some things like tipping, is there's like a certain flex to it that affects me, like even on a roll, like even a relatively soft roll is enough to put a little bit of flex in the disc that makes it more likely to bounce rather than roll smoothly. Like I have to be much softer on my rolls than normal, which is, I think, something that's harder to do and more variable.
I wonder if you're the only person in the world that would detect that, because my roll is always bouncy. I'm like, it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I get that like most people don't really roll it right anyways, but like to me it's noticeable and annoying, and it kind of plays out in other ways. Like the same problem happens with like brushing and kicking, and that's where I don't know if I get used to it. And I tried to get used to it and however long we used it, and it wasn't really happening, and I sort of gave up. But maybe it's a year-long process rather than a month-long process. I just don't know. Yeah, and I mean, I feel bad. Like I'm truly trying to be as honest as possible about how I feel about the disc, but I want to be as supportive as I possibly can be, because it's so cool that there's a company out there making a disc for freestyle. I think that gives us so much credibility, and I think they really care and are listening and trying their best, and I want to support that. And also, obviously, it's not super clear that there'll be Sky Stylers forever. And so Extus might be all we have. So we really need them to succeed and thrive. And we have a part in that. And I will keep buying Extus if for no other reason than to support Extus. These are my problems with it. And I hope that they either get better or I learn to work around them.
Okay. So the gym. Frisbeer moved gyms this year. And I think there was some uncertainty about it because Frisbeer has been at the same gym for like the last 15 years. And the gym that we normally go to is great. It's big. We know the people. The floor surface is really nice. There's like a separated restaurant area where you can like serve beer. And it's just like what we go to. So we're going to this new gym. It's a little bit smaller and it's like not in the city center. And at the end of the tournament, Jakob asked everyone how what they thought, and it was unanimous. This is a better gym. It is incredible. So there's like several things that make it amazing. The first one is we have the gym for 24 hours a day, and it has sleeping space. So that means if you are a young person who's trying to save money, you can go to the tournament. You like arrive, you put your stuff down in the back room, and that's it. You're moved in for the whole tournament. You go to sleep at night and you wake up and there's like breakfast or there's like food there, because there's like another separated place with food where like the shop and stuff is. And you're just like on the jam floor. Like there's no excuse for being late anymore. And you can jam until you're dead.
The laziest people are the most likely to be there.
Yeah, it's self-correcting.
If you party all night and fall asleep on the gym floor, like you will be at the players meeting because that's where you're sleeping.
Yeah. Also, I think this is underrated, but the gym is made out of wood and it absorbs all the sound. So there's no reverb. So when people talk, like you just like hear it. It's like it's very nice sounding, all the music and all the announcements. It's very easy to hear. And that just makes a huge difference, I think, just because it's not just like
as someone building even more sound panels for my Spin Factory, I can tell you I appreciate the value of good sound.
Yeah. The play space is great. It was plenty big for everyone we had. And as a like, this was a sweet bonus on the Friday where there was no competition. It was beautiful outside. So it was 60 degrees, which is like 14 degrees Celsius. It's in a complex, and right like across this like whatever sidewalk, there's a big turf field, and we all got to use the turf field for free for Friday jam. And it was awesome. And then when the sun set, we all just walked inside the gym and just kept jamming. It was awesome.
That part is so cool. That when I heard that it was available all day, all night, I thought that's amazing, because I think especially a tournament like Frisbeer, which is usually on a very condensed time frame with a lot of teams and a lot of rounds, if there's any problem with it, it's that there's not enough time to jam. But knowing that you get a few extra hours at the end of the day where you can jam makes a huge difference and makes me like, I think a big part of why I'm super motivated to go next year is to try this gym and be able to play longer.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. At some part of me thought the jams would go later, and some part of me thought the jams would end at the same time as usual. But it kind of like fit into this like middle ground where people stop jamming at 10 to 11 at night, which is both earlier and later than I thought.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll probably be the one annoying everybody by trying to play till midnight. But I guess a lot of people who are sleeping over probably are hanging out and partying anyway. But one thing I think is super important about having the gym space available for sleeping is I think there's a little bit of a financial crisis in freestyle in terms of making sure that tournaments have enough money to run. I think everything's getting more expensive and, you know, people's incomes aren't necessarily keeping up. And I think one, like, I do think in general, tournament directors, and I, like, this is not a very popular platform, so I'm sort of exposing myself here, should be raising the prices of registration. I think they did, but like, I think a lot of tournaments have been whatever, like $50 for 15 years. I'm like, $50 in 2009 was a lot more than $50 now. So we need to be keeping pace with inflation, period. But given that just costs are probably growing way faster than inflation and people are having trouble running these tournaments, I think if you have an opportunity that you can save the players money by giving them a place to stay for free, it makes it easier to justify an increase in the cost of the tournament. And effectively what we're doing is we're taking more of the pot of money spent to attend tournaments and taking it away from hotels and Airbnbs and giving back a portion of it to the players, but also a portion of it to the tournament directors. So either there has to be a way where the tournament directors can like charge for that, even if it's $20, like $20 times, you know, 20 people makes a big difference. And the players are saving a ton of money because instead of a, you know, $100 over the weekend, if they got a really cheap hostel, they're spending $20 period and it's going to the tournament. I mean, that's sort of like a win-win for everybody. So I hope that that can help with some of the financial troubles people are having. But I get that that's not an option for lots of events, but I think probably it's something that tournament directors can explore. Like, you can add to your to-do list of like, can I find a way to provide somehow cheaper than normal housing that I can use to make more money for the tournament?
Yeah. The being able to sleep at the gym was game changer. Like, there was a moment at the towards the end of one of the days where I was like winding down and there was just like people hanging around still. And like, normally there's people hanging around at the end of the gym, but it was like three times more than normal. Yeah. It was like everyone I played with was still there. And I had that beach weekend vibe, like feeling. And I was like, this is great. I'm like, this is where I want to be. There's like something for everybody going on right now. Yeah.
And you slept in the gym.
Nope. I slept at Yako's place like normal.
Okay, I was going to say, I mean, I'm probably not sleeping at that gym floor at this stage of my life, but you never know.
It's actually better if I sleep away from people.
Oh, yeah, because you're going to wake them up with their snoring?
Yep.
Did you ever get the deviated septum surgery or no?
No, I don't. Is there a test for that? I should see. I don't even know if I have a deviated septum.
Yeah, or if it would help your snoring. One of my friends just got one, so I've been thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Not for me. I don't snore, but it's just sort of interesting. I've thought about getting it because the people who get it say it's life-changing, but there's some risk involved in a nose surgery that don't really make sense unless you have like a real need for it.
I think that was everything with the gym. Hopefully the gym exists next year so we can go back.
I think Dexter formally agreed to host Frisbeer next year as long as my daughter's birthday was the same as his birthday or something. There was some conversation we were having over the live stream. So I know it's happening next year, but do you feel like they have enough motivation to keep it going for a couple more years at least?
They're at least going to go to the 20th anniversary. There's some debate on which year this is, if this is the 17th or the 18th edition.
Is it because they're not sure whether to count 2008 or something?
They also don't know if 2008 was the first year or not. So there would some historians gonna have to go back and find out for sure. But they'll definitely.
Well, I have a poster from 2008, so they hosted something in 2008.
They'll certainly have the motivation to go till 20. The bigger issue is if the gym is going to be demolished before next year.
The one that they used this time?
Yep.
Why would it be demolished? It's just old.
It's really old. And the owner says every year he's going to demolish it and rebuild it.
Oh, well, at least they'd rebuild it, but maybe it'd be more expensive to use.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why this can exist is because it's so old, it's affordable.
Yeah. The money thing is hard. I mean, it's think of going from a tournament where you had 100 plus people attending to 50.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a huge financial hit. Like, you have all the same upfront costs, really.
Yep.
But yeah, I think people have to just pay more. Like, I know what it sounds like for me to be the one saying, like, people need to pay more for the tournaments, but we're spending so much money to go to tournaments,
mm-hmm.
and only a tiny, tiny, tiny percent of it is going to people actually doing the event for us. We need to be making their jobs easier.
We need a first class ticket to tournaments that costs $500.
I always tell people that, and I can't remember if it was implemented for Toronto, but I always say, like, at the very least, there should be a donate button,
mm-hmm.
or something. It's like FPA has it right. Like, I get the platinum membership. It's not that much more. Like, honestly, there should be $1,000 platinum membership. Yeah. Like, this year I got three. I got one for me, Margaret, and my child. But like, if they had a more expensive one, I probably would have gotten it.
Yeah.
But which I don't want to sound like a jerk from being like, yeah, like, I'll get the more expensive one. But there are obviously people, I think, especially like Americans, because of the economic disparities in the world and the fact that a lot of Americans are like older freestylers who've had a full adult life of working and have more disposable income, that will be happy and will bring them joy to spend more money to support the events. And I think like the platinum membership thing, like, that feels better to me than like donating for some reason. Like, I don't love like having to figure out like, where is this, mm-hmm. like, you know, Russian Kickstarter I have to find. And I have to like navigate all the politics and etiquette of that, of like, how much do I give them? Like, do I do it anonymously? Like, do I post about it? Like, for me, I just like, I can buy an anonymous platinum membership. I get like an extra t-shirt or something that I can use to justify the cost, and it's one and done. Like, that to me is way like easier process for me.
Okay.
But I'm not saying you shouldn't do a Kickstarter. Like, I get that you also want to be able to reach people who are not going that want to donate. But for someone like me who is going, give me the VIP option. Like, it's like Virginia. I always get the Lost Weekend package, even though I know I'm going to eat $10 of food,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to pay $80 for it because I feel good getting my Lost Weekend badge or whatever. Like, you can't underestimate humans' capacity to value meaningless nonsense. Like, give me an extra hat and I will pay you an extra $200. Like, that's all it takes. Obviously the Kickstarters have learned this. It's like, level one, it's $5 for a sticker. Level two, it's $10,000 and you get a shirt. Just a little bit more to feel like you're paying for some value, and everyone wins.
You got to trigger that FOMO.
Yeah, like, you got to abuse our monkey brains, you know?
Yeah.
We're easy to deceive. You have to make us think we're winning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that was it for the gym. So the third new thing we tried this year was an elimination style turbo shred. So we didn't execute it properly, but this is something, format we haven't tried yet, which is everyone's in one big pool and you give everyone a chance to go. That counts as one round. And at the end of each round, the lowest score gets eliminated. And it was cumulative this year. So all your attempts all added together, and whoever had the lowest sum of all their attempts got eliminated each round until there was a winner at the end. So when we were starting, there was only 6 in open and 4 in women. So there were 10. So I was like, oh, we'll just eliminate one person each round. It'll be 6 rounds. But then when we started, there was like 12 people. So it ended up being 12 rounds. And
That's a long time.
Yeah. It was a grind.
I do like that idea. I would definitely have eliminated more per round.
Yep.
So it wasn't crazy. How did the cumulative thing work out?
It was fine. So I had to run the computer. I made a spreadsheet and I was doing it all. So everyone would just yell out a number and I'd write down everyone's number in a cell and it would do all the summing for us. And if that was not possible, it would be a headache. Because even for me, it was a little overwhelming because it was like a lot of numbers, but it was fine. Like, it moved along really quickly. I think people kind of understood that it was going to take a long time. So like, the throws were like back to back. There was like 6 seconds of downtime between each person.
The turbo shred's the only thing I didn't see for some reason, but who won in the end, open and women's?
So Anka won open and Bianca won women.
See, that makes a lot of sense to me just in a vacuum because they both have a really good combination of consistency and, I don't know, high skill.
Yep.
But yeah, I think I like cumulative. I kind of like both extremes. I like the you're going for the biggest move and you can drop it 10 times to get it. But also I like the cumulative thing. I think the cumulative thing probably better assesses like overall freestyle skill and maybe better evaluates. Like, look, Turbo Shred is the most narcissistic of all the aspects of competition, but at least the cumulative aspect of it values something that we value in freestyle general, which is like being good at catching it and like the skills that you would need to do well in that would translate to being a good jammer. So that definitely intrigues me. But did you feel like people were holding back in a way that was deteriorating the product because they needed to catch more?
I don't think so. I think it was actually the other extreme. So in the cumulative, it's better to be consistent. But I think a mistake people were making was they would put their hardest move at the front. Like they would do standing guided pull off the throw. And if they missed it, they would get zero. But if they just took it in the, did some easy pulls and then did the guided pull, they would get partial credit for their cumulative score. So there were a lot of zeros.
I feel like this is one of my best tricks that I think, I mean, not that it's mine, I'm sure lots of other people do too, but like, especially in a competition, you get so much value for escalating during a combo because not only do you get what you just said, which is that your risk of dropping it happens at the end, so you already have accrued points, but the hardest moves are the coolest at the end.
Mm-hmm.
One from a story arc, just like a story, you want the climax at the end, not at the beginning. But also because I think people intuit and perceive that you've already used a lot of spin, you've already done all this stuff, and you're still escalating. And that has a whole nother aspect of difficulty. So it's both more difficult and safer in terms of maximizing your score, or not safer in terms of executing the hard move. But yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. Although it would be a bummer that it would disincentivize cool pulls off the throws, because I think those are always really awesome. It's also a little bit unfortunate because pulls at the throw are as much about the thrower as they are about yep. the person doing the move, but that's a whole nother aspect. So that's cool. I like that. Who were like the final three in open?
Oh, I know Edo was in the top three. I'm trying to think who was in the top two. I'm thinking it was Edo, Chesco, and Anka. That would be my guess.
Yeah, that's a classic trio right there. That's amazing. It seemed like there were a lot of the top players were at this year.
I think there was 9 out of the 10 top. You were the only non-top 10 player not there.
But there's a sleeping giant that none of these people are ready for as well. I still watch, you know, I used to watch tournaments when I was gone and be like, man, if I were there, I would do all these things and they would be in deep trouble. But this time I was like, oh man, Will would have quadded that. Like, you guys don't even know what's about to come hit you.
Yeah, I'm. You tell me about Will on a daily basis. Like the amount of time you spend talking about Will versus talking about your new child is like the discrepancy.
That's because you and I talk about free stuff. If you want to hear about my child sleeping for 4 hours straight, I'll start sending you those texts. But yeah, I don't want to overhype Will either, because that's its own curse. Like, he still has a lot of learning and growth to do. But I just think in terms of like what he can do is already so high, and he has our mindset built into him in terms of how he would approach competition.
Yeah, the mindset is so important. Okay.
And he is my child. He's my adopted frisbee child.
Does that mean I'm the uncle, right? In this.
Yeah, you're the uncle and no more than that. I know one day I'm gonna be like, you know, in my deathbed and Will's gonna be accepting his lifetime achievement award, and they're gonna be like, who are your biggest influences? He's gonna go, Ryan Young. And it's gonna name like six other people, and oh yeah, James too. And I'm gonna be like, no.
That's how you know you were the dad in that situation. You were the
forgotten one. You're like the cool grandparent or the cool uncle.
But yeah, okay. There was one more thing I wanted to talk about at Frisbeer, and it's variety in the judging system. So I think variety has been overlooked, and I want to get your take. So let's just go first high level, underrated or overrated variety in competition.
I think now it's overrated. I mean, I've talked a lot about variety and I've gone back and forth a lot. And I think I value variety a lot in the abstract. I think it reflects skill and skill that's meaningful. Like, I think I talk all the time about moves overrated. Like learning a bunch of moves just to learn a bunch of moves. I don't really care about that. But I do think variety is valuable in a way that's intrinsically good, which is if you know how to do lots of things, you are a better jammer because of it. And you have answers to all different kinds of problems and you can prevent things from getting stale. Like there's so many values to variety. I mean, if we were all doing the same things and the same combinations over and over again, what's the point of playing at a certain point? Like we have to keep finding new ways to play. But there's lots of counter arguments to it in the competition format particularly. And I don't want to like reiterate something I've said before or talked about more extensively, but I do think it's not obvious that a routine with more variety is better in the abstract than a routine without it. I mean, you can make the coolest routine in the world that's all different kinds of guides. Like, I mean, I think in some ways, and this is almost unintuitive, valuing variety too highly restricts the kinds of routines you can make. You have to be much more, it forces you into a certain kind of bucket, mm-hmm. which is the thing that I always wanted to avoid in the judging system. Like, I don't want to force people to play a certain way, but you can't build a super thematic routine in a overly valued variety system, because all your themes are just going to be viewed as lack of variety, for instance. Yeah. And look, you can quibble and say, well, like you can build a whole routine of different guides that should have high variety. Sure, you might have a high quantitative variety, but you're going to get penalized in qualitative because the judges are going to say, yeah, but you didn't have enough rolls, kicks, UD, whatever. So like I say all that, I think I was the one who pushed really hard to make variety more valuable in the new system, for lack of better phrasing. But like I've kind of been worried that it's been too valuable now.
I agree.
It's also...
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. I agree. It's overrated and it's overvalued, but it was a really good experiment. Like I think we learned a lot from having it in the judging system and giving it like one whole judge. What I noticed at Frisbeer is it's the determining factor a lot of times. So in the past, we talked about diff being the determining factor because it's nonlinear. But what happened at this Frisbeer is everyone had about the same level of diff. Like everyone's catching two or three doubles and like a bunch of singles. So even though they're getting a lot of diff points, everyone has the same level of diff points. And there wasn't a lot of like three triple routines that can get the nines and tens to really get that really high end of the tail. But the variety, we were seeing like 10 point swings. So like diff would have like 2 to 3 points between the top teams, but variety could swing like 15 points between the teams.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other big problems of variety, which was kind of the original problem with variety, which we talked about before, so I won't harp on it too much, is that even if we value it conceptually, it's very difficult to know how to turn that value into a set of rules that we can use to judge routines, which is why we've had 10 different systems to value variety, and all of them are very unsatisfactory,
yep.
including the current one. In other words, like to put it a little more simply, like you can really value something, but it might be impossible to judge quickly, efficiently, and consistently. And I think one problem with every variety system, but maybe especially the new one, is that it makes it easy for variety to be a proxy for other things, which means you're like double counting them. So probably like if you have a good reputation, you're going to get a high qualitative variety score, regardless of whether you deserve it, because the judges are like defaulting to that. And let me pause for a second to say, I want to do a whole episode about this book I read. It's the latest Daniel Kahneman book with another author who I feel bad that I can't remember his name, but they wrote a book called Noise. And it's about the concept of noise, which is, like bias is noise in a particular direction. Like the analogy at the end of the book is you imagine shooting at a target. Bias would be all the shots are like 4 inches away from the center. Mm-hmm. Noise would be all the shots are like wider away from a particular point, whether it's the center or not. And like one of the big points of the book is that improving noise has the same overall judgment value as improving bias. But everyone focuses on bias and they don't focus on noise, but noise is way easier to change than bias. I need to go way more into it. It's like super interesting. And I haven't even like done it yet is I think it'll have work on my part. And I'll have to like reread this book and like really lay it out, but it has so many insights for judging. And Daniel Kahneman's a Nobel Prize winning economist. And a lot of what he has done is do work on people's judgment and behaviors and how they assess candidates for jobs and things like that. Like he would be the perfect person to put on the freestyle judging panel to help us build a better judging system. And like reading this book, it was like reading about the history of mistakes in the freestyle judging system in other contexts and thinking like, we made that mistake, or if we did that, we could fix this other problem. But I wanted to mention it as soon as we were talking about something judging related, to just kind of put a pin in it for something we can come back to. And it provides a lot of tools we could use to fix the judging system that I don't think we implemented. Although I'm proud to say, I think we did do a lot of things that this book would have, you know,
supported.
We also did a few things it wouldn't support. But like one of the concepts in the book, which is just like a somewhat obvious behavioral economics concept, which we talk about without having the right terms. And I can't remember the term he uses, but it's something like transference of like when something's really difficult to judge, we instead unconsciously judge something that's easier to judge.
Yep.
So when we have something like variety qualitative and it's not obvious how to judge that, what our brain does is it goes to an easier question, which is like, who's a better player? Like these people are better. I'm going to give them a better judge score. And I think there's like an example of this where they say like, okay, John is shy and quiet and likes to spend time alone. Is he more likely to be one of four things, like an accountant, a surfer, a music lover, or like a party goer? And like, I'm not giving the proper example, but a lot of people will be like, well, like an accountant, he's like shy and quiet. But it's like, no, you're actually like missing the better way to judge it, which would be, which of these things by itself is more common? Like party goer, everyone goes to parties. Like he's a party goer for sure. It's like, that's actually quite unlikely that they're an accountant. Like the idea that like illustrates a bunch of different things we do wrong. But like one of the things is like, we answer the wrong question. Like, and I think there's a lot of our judging categories that we could kind of tweak and change to make it easier and more obvious what your brain is supposed to be doing, so you don't unconsciously do something else. That's a large digression. I'm going to get so many things wrong about it, but there's so much insight in that book for what we do in judging that I would love to try to present. And just hopefully I can talk myself into doing it without doing the work that would be necessary to do it properly. But I think variety is a classic example. Like, it's too hard for people to judge effectively, and it's not really working out for us very well.
Like we have there's like the carrot and the stick we hear a lot about. And right now The carrot is like the incentive. Variety is now an incentive. So the more variety you do, the more reward you get. But I think what most people think about variety wise is repetition and how repetition is bad, which is like the stick. Like you should punish the repetition. But if you don't have a lot of repetition, then it's fine. Do you think that's more like what people think about variety? And like maybe the next system can be built that way.
I definitely agree. Although I do think that can go wrong in some ways too, of people doing purposeful artistic repetition in a certain way. But like that's where I think if you were smart about it, like I try to do that and create variety in ways that create literal variety for the judges, but have the same aesthetic of like, we'll do the same exact thing counter, or we'll do it switching positions, so like we can get some variety value, but still have these themes that I like to have. But I like that. And I think there's probably a way to find like a new version of variety. And I think ultimately this all goes back to what we've talked about a lot, which is it's fine for the judging system to change and for the system to iterate and players to iterate to the system. And I think we had a variety system now that people have adjusted to and it's had value, and now it can change to something a little bit different.
Yep, I agree.
I hate to admit it, though. This book basically says you're right about so many things that I push back on you about. And it's really upsetting. But a couple like quick hits that are really interesting. One is basically an algorithm beats pure human judgment 100% of the time. And it's not a ton. It's like a little bit. Like you can take any system and go from just tell us what you think is best to like, here are five things to think about. Give them a number, add them up, then tell us what you think is best. And if you just like make algorithm sounds really fancy and complicated, it's like literally adding any objective measure, like splitting up in any way and taking out a little bit of the subjectivity makes people make better judgments. And these are things that are measurable, not just like they're better at deciding that art looks good. It's like, we are giving you something that we know the answer to and asking you to make a judgment on it. And if we give you some kind of basic algorithm, it always, every single time, improves your judgment. Like that is at least support for our idea of like, don't just tell people to give a number between 1 and 100, like give them the five things to think about. But it's like that really stuck with me. Although there is a caveat, which is there's only one thing that can beat a basic algorithm and only by a tiny amount, which is machine learning, which we're obviously not going to be able to do for freestyle judging anytime soon, but you never know. So I really like that idea, but I also really like the idea of reducing noise rather than bias. So like, it's going to be really hard for us to fix bias, but there are lots of ways that we can improve noise.
Like setting baselines. Yeah.
And a lot of the book is just simplifying of like making the parameters narrower makes people much better judges, and or even like staging it of like put it into buckets 1, 2, or 3. And once you've done that, it's easier for you to take the things that are in bucket 3 and assess those. So like if you gave me 100 things to categorize from 0 to 100, it would be almost impossible. But if you tell me to split it into 3 groups and then split each of those 3 groups into 3 groups and like continue on, like then I could actually do it quite effectively. And I think that sounds complicated, but it's something you could do even now with our current judging system of like, first, so I'm going to look at, I mean, I'm assuming a few things here, but like assuming I can change all my scores at the end, like the round is over. My job now is I'm going to split it in half and be like, these 4 teams are out, these 4 teams are in. Now let's, how do I degrade between these teams? I mean, there's all these like little things we can do to like improve the system without making it harder. In fact, making it a little bit easier. And I'm like excited to talk about like what we could maybe do to do that. But there's one last thing I'll say about it. It's just a life hack I learned that I've been implementing that's super useful, which is when you have to make a judgment on something, like a guess about something. So let's say you're guessing the probability that the Dodgers win the World Series this year. You come up with a number in your head. You say it's 20% chance. I know nothing about baseball, so I have no idea if that's a ridiculous assumption or not. I bet you it's much lower based on the little bit I know about baseball. But you say, no, I think it's 20%. Now, your judgment will be way better if you had other people's judgments to add to the poll, like independent judgments. But you might not have that option. So what can you do? You can give yourself a second judgment and average the two. It's like so easy. You're like, okay, well, if I didn't think it was 20%, let's assume 20% is wrong. What would my next judgment be? Well, 5%. And then you average them. When people do that, their judgments are like 20 or 30% better. I can't remember the exact
number. I believe it.
So I've been like doing that all the time now. It's even better if you can like add a day between the two of like whenever I'm trying to predict something in the future that having a prediction for can help me change my behavior. I've been trying to do a couple of different independent, they're not really because it's my brain, but try to make a few judgments and then add them together. I can imagine doing that during a freestyle round of like, I want to give that a 9, but if it wasn't a 9, what would it be? Like it would be a 7. So let's give it an 8.5 or whatever.
I'm surprised you don't do this already with other parts. Like, don't you write a draft and then you wait a day and then you read it again and you're like, wait, isn't that
for sure? But I think like in casual day-to-day judgments, I don't think I really like think about it that much.
I see. I don't do casual. Everything in my brain is that way.
I do probably way more than other people like assign judgment, like numbers to things. Like I definitely have tons of whatever anxiety. Like I hate to say it out loud, but I do. And a lot of times what makes me feel better is I say like, okay, what is the numerical probability that you assign to that bad outcome happening? And most of the time I'm like 0% or 1%. And that makes me feel better.
Okay.
But when it is something where maybe something bad actually might happen, I can refine my judgment by doing this averaging technique in a way that I find super useful.
I like it. Yeah.
But I'll write my little book report at some point and try to present.
We'll have an episode.
Yeah. Okay. What else do we have today?
I think that was the last. That was the last thing in my list. Was there any? Yeah.
I think that's it. That was great. Thanks for doing all the work now. We have all these random episodes we've recorded. I don't know what order they're going to come out in. So maybe this is known or not, but Ryan has taken over basically in retirement and is making my job really easy now that I am a parent, and it's much appreciated. And I think you're doing a great job. So thank you.
Cool. All right. So send us your comments and questions and feedback to clockercounter@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.